The Diary of Ellen Rimbauer, Disc 2.
I kept my thoughts to myself the first time he mentioned the trip, and the second, and the third, always telling myself there would be plenty of time to set the course straight. That course now starts tomorrow. Pier 47. We steam to Victoria, switch ships and board for the Tahitian Islands. I see in myself this hesitation to confront John, a reluctance to spoil his good moods or dare to enter his bad ones. He lives on these giant swings like an ape, back and forth, high to low. Perhaps the great Sigmund Freud, about whom everyone is talking. His publication on the sexual theory is under translation into English, but is said by Germans who have read it to be quite scandalous and intriguing. Would have some way to quantify John's moods. For me, they are difficult to read and dangerous to intrude upon. At his most elevated moments, he is so exciting and stimulating to be around, animated, courteous, and entertaining. At his low points, he is sullied, dark and brooding. I fear him. I anticipate violence at times, though have yet to see, and I hope I never will, this side of him rise to the surface. If John ever does become violent with me, I tremble at the thought. He is a big man, strong and imposing. I fear he could crush me like an insect. I read the last few paragraphs and wonder that I could put such thoughts to ink on our wedding day of all days. My mother tells me that she too had reservations prior to her wedding. She told me other things as well, concerning what to expect on my wedding night, but they are best left between mother and daughter. That it is not uncommon for a woman to question her decision, and that men go through much the same thing. I must admit that John, bless his heart, has never for an instant voiced anything but total support for and faith in our union. In fact, one of the great ironies here is that the concern is all mine. John, for his part, seems absolutely giddy with the marriage. He has been a saint throughout its planning, has financed a good deal of the reception and celebration, a much-appreciated gesture from my father, and has often been boyish with glee about the approaching date. Now he waits for me at the church. I can picture him there, in his finest London-tailored tails, white gloves clasped behind his back like a general awaiting his army. In this case, my arm, not an arm me. I annoyed John with my puns, but what liberties I have here. Standing there at the altar, an occasional grin steals its way onto his otherwise composed expression. He is a man of great vision, and I know that he sees much ahead for us, and I trust him to make the most of it. Yes, it is true that at times I fear he regards me more as a broodmare than a mate. That as a man turned 40 with a sizable fortune, he is looking more for an heir than a companion. That, dare I say it, women of pleasure are there to pleasure, and a wife is there to bear and raise children. He will want a son, of course, will not stop breeding me until I throw one for him. I see all this in his eyes, hear all this between the lines of his reasoning. As long as the love is there as well, and it is, I am not deterred by his intentions. Love, true love, provides an abundance of good. I go in just a matter of minutes to profess that same love before God, family, and all our friends. And oh, how I do love my John Rimbauer. I go with courage. I go with faith. Great anticipation. I go without doubt or expectation. Let love carry us where it may. I am ready. I am ready. I am ready. November 13th, 1907. Aboard SS Ocean Star. Oh my! Where to start? The marriage? The reception? Dare I ever put in these pages a recounting of the marriage night itself? The pain, the pleasure, the fulfillment of dreams, the fear, the feeling of overwhelming consumption, as if possessed by him. Another time, perhaps, although some things are better left to blossom in memory rather than wither in reflection. Here we are aboard the Ocean Star, a luxurious steamer bound for Tahiti, in a presidential stateroom fit for a king and queen, 3 rooms and a full bath with WC. We dine at the captain's table tonight, black tie and evening dress, and begin our Pacific crossing. If the rest of the trip is anything like our first few hours, it is to be spent in the union of marital bliss. We have been together twice already, and only on the ship for 4 hours. John has gone topside for a cigar, and to hope to collect telegraphs he's expecting concerning both business and the construction out at the Grand House. The complexity of the project has continued to consume him. To my knowledge, the only day he was completely away from it was our wedding day. And for all I know, he had one of his many business associates keeping him current even then. He has informed me that he wants the house decorated to reflect our travels, to remind him of our various ports of call, and that it is my duty to spend as much money as possible to that end. Yes, he was kidding, of course, but his eyes twinkled in such a way as to tell me he was serious as well. Even now, I am only beginning to glimpse how wealthy we are. Comments like the one to which I refer would have seemed something fit for one of the tawdry novels I read, not for a serious comment from my husband. The house alone is costing a fortune, literally. This trip, another fortune entirely. And yet, I sense these fortunes are but mere play toys to John. Could there be a bottomless well from which John draws our funds? Is such a possibility anything more than pure fancy? Whatever the case, I am thrilled with this challenge of his. I expect to collect many objets d'art, decorations, and furnishings, so that he shall never forget our voyage. Without John's knowledge, I paid for and kept the sheets from our marriage bed at the hotel, crimson stains and all. I wanted a souvenir of that night as badly as he wants souvenirs of our trip. I carry them with me in one of my 6 steamer trunks, wrapped in tissue paper and a red bow. Something feels so shameful about this action, especially preserving my virgin blood, and I hesitate to think of John's anger if he were to ever find out. And so it is that we start our marriage with secrets. We start our marriage holding on to some small part of ourselves, treasured and kept private. Is this wrong, I ask myself? Or does a woman have to hold on to something in the face of such overwhelming surrender? He climbs on top of me, and he possesses me in a way I never imagined could be true. Inside me. Occupying me. Pleasure. And pain. And I wonder, will I ever get used to it? Teak from the islands. Ivory from the dark continent. I have begun to make lists in my head. Thankfully, John has brought along a complete set of plans to the Grand House, allowing me to anticipate placement of our forthcoming collection. Now, not just John, but husband and wife shall be poring over those plans day and night. Now, finally, the project can consume us both. I have become a part of that great house that owns so much of my dear husband. I feel myself inside its walls. He enters me. He resides in me. I sweat and I writhe in his presence. My walls shudder. My mind reels. He comes and goes from our stateroom, having not invited me to join him topside. Returning just now, smelling of liquor and cigar, he pulls the underclothes from my trembling body, lifts my skirts, and drives me against the far wall, the sound of the ocean and the rumble of the ship. He lifts me from the floor, pulling my legs around his waist, and I am carried away to the point of frenzy, the point that any shard of ladylike behavior is lost to his lust, his penetration. My lipstick smeared, my breast exposed and the object of his attention, I can no longer maintain my composure. I cry out into the stateroom, "Oh, John, dear John," my fingers raking the back of his dress shirt. "Dear God in heaven, I have never... And all my shameful release so unexpectedly serves to engorge him, to send him into a fevered pitch, a furious, frantic pace, where the thumping of my bare bottom on the wall runs up my spine and fills my ears like drumming. He pins my arms to that same wall, his face a crimson cry, and I wail behind his release like some wounded animal, humiliated and reduced to a trembling, panting state of spent excitement. And he loves it. He leaves the stateroom yet again, neglecting to offer me his company. Me, ruffled, sitting quietly on a chair, awaiting his departure so I can tend to my toilet. He, his eyes flashing, his white teeth grinning at me, and without a word, he departs. The air is no longer tainted with liquor and cigar, but with our commingled scents, dark and somewhat sour. I freshen it with perfume. I open the doors to the balcony. I stand with the wind whipping my hair, flushed with a woman's satisfaction, embarrassed with myself, and yet exhilarated. I am a wife. I have made the transition. November 19th, 1907, aboard SS Ocean Star. A brief note in an effort to keep myself company. I have torn out and discarded many of your pages, dear diary. Small knots of white paper in the trash as I attempt to come to terms with my position. Dearest John is quick to display me at dinner or lunch, or an evening reception offered by one guest or another. But the remainder of my time on board the ship resembles more prison than honeymoon, as he confines me to our stateroom, where I must admit I am taken to nausea in the early winter seas that we encounter. I have begged to go topside to relieve myself of this condition, for fresh air and a firm horizon can do wonders to steady my stomach. But my husband steadfastly refuses me, saying that he doesn't want any displays on deck. He points to the balcony off the stateroom and suggests its use for my purposes. He is afraid I might vomit or show my pale face, I suppose. No Rimbauer ever shows weakness. He uses me as a charm on his bracelet, while claiming that the less others see of me, the more mystery, the more power I hold over them at the captain's table, afternoon teas and cocktail parties. When he does visit me in my confinement, it is to take of me his pleasure. With no other trustworthy woman in whom to confide, I have no idea if this is normal or not. Though I must admit, It is thoroughly exhausting, if in no other way, in terms of bathing and dressing. I must spend half my day being undressed by him, later bathing, and finding new wardrobes to replace the last. What appetites he has! I find myself at least a bit unstable, with the only attentions his, and these so clearly physical. Only this morning did it occur to me, from something he said, that he is hiding me from the other men on board. The silliest, boyish notion I can imagine. John? Jealous? The conversation went something like this. John asked me, "Did you notice Mr. Jamerson last evening?" "Notice how, dear?" "Does the word notice escape your comprehension, Ellen?" His tone immediately sharp and coercive. I feel myself being drawn into a fight, and worse, I find myself willing to go. Why, I wonder? Because he locks me in this stateroom, a captive, readying myself for his next fit of womanly satisfaction? It does not. Taken literally, I most certainly did notice Mr. Jamerson. He sat immediately to my right, as you will recall. And the captain placed you to his right for the fourth dinner in a row. He pauses, strutting now about the stateroom. The chair of highest honor on a ship, its occupation to be rotated night to night through a variety of guests. I am honored. You are the most beautiful woman on this ship, Ellen, by a factor of 10. You flatter me. I caution you, he said. A ship is a lonely place. What are you saying? You needn't take to their humor quite so vigorously. Your endowments, my dear. He indicates his own chest, meaning mine, of course. Quite an eyeful when you laugh like that. I blush, for I can feel it in my face. Not from embarrassment, as he must suspect, but anger. Is he implying that I am purposefully being vulgar in such company? Is this the kind of thing husbands and wives argue over? May I remind you that it is you, dear husband, who bids me to remove my shawl at the dinner table, such as my bosom may be, and I might remind you, as if that's necessary, that Miss Pauling, our ship's entertainer, and a guest I notice who has come to address you most informally, John, has a substantially greater bosom than I, and is in a mood to display her wares in what I consider, quite frankly, a most inappropriate and lascivious way. Moreover, my gowns are crafted by the finest San Francisco seamstresses and fashioned to designs created by Paul Poiret himself, and that all of this was at your request. These gowns were ordered because you heard of them, or saw them, for all I know, on that business trip last August. I take great umbrage at any implication from you that I have behaved in any way unbecoming. I was born, bred, and raised a lady, dear sir, and you will kindly remember that fact before leveling such accusations at me. I meant only, you meant to say that when I laugh, my bosom is on display. And believe me, this fact does not escape me. I have nearly come out of my gown. I am terribly aware of that fact. So perhaps your indignation might give way in favor of allowing a woman to wear her shawl when she sees fit, rather than forcing her into compromising moments of great embarrassment. Now, leave me alone. Go do whatever it is you do on this dreadful ship. But if you return with Miss Pauling's perfume on you, John, as you did 2 nights ago, oh yes, you thought I missed that. How could I? It's a dreadful scent. Then there will be hell to pay. I had lost all composure and found myself shouting at the top of my lungs. At my husband, to my regret. But, oh, dear diary, the story does not stop there, for I swear it is true that upon mention of the word hell, did the gas lights in that stateroom dim and the bedroom door blow open. Behind this door came a wind that lifted my nightgown from the floor and blew my hair straight back off my shoulders. And yet John moved not a hair. His handkerchief did not wave. The curtains did not ruffle. As my heartbeat did subside, so too did this wind lessen. John and I stood perfectly still, a silence between us. The air crisp and smelling as it does after an electric storm, both bitter and sweet all at once. My husband said not a word, a stunned, apoplectic expression overtaking him. His eyes narrowed, boring into me. He turned and left me then, partly because there was nothing left to say, partly out of fear, if I read him right. I have never seen John Rimbauer seeming anything less than absolutely certain, stoic even, until now, that is. This evening, the tables turned. I attended dinner without a shawl, just to spite him, and I laughed as never before.
For the sake of expediency, and due to any diary's repetitious nature, the editor chose to omit various diary entries. Ellen Rimbauer's full diary is archived in the Winslow Library of Letters and Memoirs, Seattle, Washington, a copy of which resides, along with other materials, in the Joyce Reardon collection. Observed Paranormal Activities, 1982 to 1999, which resides in the Wurmser Library, Beaumont University, Seattle, Washington. Joyce Reardon.
December 15th, 1907. The South Pacific Islands. I don't know why they bother giving these islands any name but paradise. Certainly one is no different from the other. A crust of sand rising from the deep, palms clinging by shallow roots, wind and bright sky, and the bluest, clearest water on the face of the earth. The cinnamon-skinned women, as bare-breasted as the National Geographic Society would have us believe, welcoming white strangers with wide smiles and, I fear, open arms. The sun beats hot as we enter the part of their seasons that coincides with spring and summer, despite it being fall and early winter at home. Our world is quite literally turned upside down. I lock your pages closed each night, dear diary, and then, in turn, lock you away in my steamer where I keep my underclothes and my toilet, confident my husband would never violate that sanctity. I scarcely know what would become of me if he ever did. And so it is, with beating heart and a certain amount of timidity, that I once again turn to you as my confessor. It began more than a week ago now, during a nighttime celebration as the ocean star crossed the equator. There was music, much drink, a proclamation by the captain, dancing, and a gay atmosphere on board. John and I, for all our conflicts, rose from our beds in the morning as if we had not a care in the world. We had taken breakfast together on the balcony, a peaceful, enchanting hour. I do believe that John has adopted a different attitude toward me, and that this is reflected both in our breakfast and in the fact that we followed breakfast with a stroll on the deck. An extremely social activity where certainly my absence has been noticed. We lunched together in a smaller dining room I'd not seen before, but one where all the waiters knew John quite well, addressing him as Mr. Rimbauer instead of the Sir and Madam, used on guests less well known. After high tea, with several new friends, we retired to our stateroom and rested, John's new term for our husband and wife activities, which falls desperately short of the truth of that time spent together. It is anything but restful. And prepared for a late dinner at the captain's table, and the equator celebration scheduled to follow. It was sometime during that fabulous celebration, the warm tropical night winds playing over the ocean star's rail, the champagne playing with my head, the delicious chocolate mousse still lingering in my taste buds, that the following events occurred. John, I believe, was dancing with a matronly woman named Danforth. Danvers? I have a devil of a time with all the names, leaving me to the company of Mr. Dan, I can't possibly remember, who rather quickly excused himself to the toilet, one brandy over his limit, if I might say. Truffles, madam? A creamy, warm voice over my shoulder, as welcome as that tropical wind. A woman's voice, deep and soothing. I turned, perhaps too quickly for our proximity, and found myself eye to eye with a negro of nut-brown skin and enormous olive-shaped eyes. Her face was a perfect oval, her lips thick and sensuous. I felt myself stir in a way no woman should stir for another woman. I am certain I made a fool of myself, the way my voice caught, with the blush I must have revealed. A waitress, she was dressed in a black costume appropriate to her service, with a white apron and a firmly pressed white collar, buttoned nearly to choking. She had a tiny wasp waist, full hips and strong legs, widely set. The shoes they had put her in were easily a size too large. She had feet more my size. What an idiot I was, just staring into her eyes as I did. Madam? She inquired a second time. Well, yes, I answered, having no desire to consume any more food. But I picked one off the silver tray nonetheless, and bid her to remain in my company a moment longer. What I felt is unspeakable, but I push my fountain pen to write it here in these pages. I wanted to kiss her, to touch that soft skin. Mind you, I did not want to be kissed back, heaven forbid, nor touched in any way, shape, or manner. But I did want to undress her and see her God-given body in all its glory, to run my hands over her skin and feel it respond to my woman's touch. So horrified was I by this response that I left the celebration early, feigning a headache, and I returned to prayer in our stateroom, kneeling at the side of that bed where my husband and I perform acts of increasing indecency, praying for salvation from wherever it is my mind seems destined to take me. Is this what marriage brings on in women? A heightened curiosity of the forms that pleasure takes? If there were only someone to whom I could bear my soul. The ship's priest comes to mind, but he is a roomy-eyed man with a proclivity for drink. My one great fear now is that in all my isolation of the forthcoming year, I will not find answers, not find release for such sinful thought. For the better part of 3 weeks, I have been shuttered in our stateroom. I am currently ensconced in a 5-room suite in the only decent hotel for 1,000 miles. Laughter rolls up from the hotel bar, spilling out into the street, and then rising like hot air to the room's high ceilings. Dare I confess this? Earlier this morning, a chambermaid entered to service our rooms, to change the sheets that my husband and I have soiled with our activities. I dare not ask where John has learned all that he is teaching me his term. She couldn't have been over 15 if she's a day. Petite and fair-skinned with black eyes and a strong back. Oh, yes, I studied every inch of her as she worked. She saw me watching and seemed to take great pleasure in it. Giggling, provocative. She knows not what she does to me. I had a kink in my neck that I tried to work out. There are no pillows here to speak of, only firm square mats with cotton slipcovers. I sleep fitfully, if at all, in part because John's appetites are insatiable. He drinks heavily into the night, and then arrives to our rooms in a desirous state. Our maid took note of my efforts and indicated that I should turn around. She touched my neck with her small warm hands, and I jumped, a source of great amusement on her part. Then, for the better part of a quarter of an hour or more, she kneaded my tight, knotted muscle and sculpted it, restoring it to a state of complete relaxation. I am told this form of massage is Asian, Japanese or Chinese in origin, and spilled down the archipelago over the thousands of years of commerce that has come and gone in this remote area of the world. I was quite taken by the magic of her hands, and I tipped her generously, which she clearly enjoyed. But listen, dear diary, there's more. This young beauty then indicated that I should lie down on the bed. In her unfamiliar tongue and sign language, she first locked the door and then motioned for me to disrobe. I am certain this was the meaning. It needed no translation. She indicated with her hands that she would continue her work, the Asian massage with which she had soothed me. She appreciated my generosity, no doubt, and saw clear to the idea that she might expand on that gratuity by increasing the canvas, if I may adopt an art analogy. I declined, of course, thanking her profusely, which I'm sure she understood, and getting out of it as best I could. I suppose she meant for me to remove my dress, and only my dress, so that she could continue her work through my undergarments. But given the level of undress these natives undertake, my thoughts went elsewhere. I had visions of disrobing, becoming naked in front of this young girl. Even now, many hours passed, I find myself excited at the prospect. Dare I confess this? To be touched by another woman? Someone of my own sex, who would know the aches and pains of a woman, where to touch, where to relieve the back pain that comes of the corsets, the foot and leg pain that comes from the shoes. Nothing more than this, you understand? And yet, even this seems a sinful act. One woman with another, one in full undress? The bright-eyed young girl had such a problem accepting no from me, either being driven by the desire for another tip, or being culturally unfamiliar with such a refusal. This island and its simple people are so very foreign to me. I am troubled by my desires. There, I wrote it down. Perhaps that will help to purge me of them. Perhaps if John included me more, allowed me out more often, my mind would have elsewhere to go other than to the physical pleasures that have entered my life for the first time in these past few weeks. The dark secrets of satisfying a man that John continues to reveal to me. But my days are just this, food and carnal pleasure. The honeymoon is for me more a horror moon. I have prayed to both sides for release from this depravity of thought, for increased independence from my husband, for the freedom to walk the sands and visit the markets. I have prayed for his drinking to temper, for his earlier return to our suite, as some nights he does not return until 3 or 4 in the morning, sweating, smelling of liquor and cigars, and, dare I say it, for I am not absolutely certain, other women. He snores as I cry. He snores as I long for home, and most of all my dear mother. Her guidance, her advice. Oh, the ache in my heart this loss causes me. The terror with which I face another day here, for I know it is but one of many that will combine to make up this year of travel. There is talk of a European war. John believes the need for petroleum will increase dramatically, and with it our fortunes. But what good is fortune without love? And if John loves me, what strange ways he chooses to display it. Is love at the heart of our sweaty embrace? I once felt this. It seems like months ago now. But since our arrival here at the islands, it is bestiality that my husband brings to bed, not love. He takes me. He does not make love to me. It is carnal and awful, and I give myself to him only reluctantly and with great displeasure for fear of suffering badly should I do otherwise. I know not what I've gotten myself into, and all I want is out. April 19th, 1908, Kenya, Africa. Africa, the dark continent, a man's place, primitive and intriguing. The birthplace of mankind, they say. Eden, they say. Skin so black it's blue. Wild animals in numbers that stagger the imagination. Oh, to have a motion picture camera record this. John and I, and three other couples, two from Britain, one from Cleveland. Ironically, he and John share some business acquaintances there. Are escorted into the bush by nearly 30 natives, an Australian guide named Charles Hammer, and a Negro gun-bearer named Hipshu. At least that's how we all pronounce it. About 10 of the 30 are women, two of whom are assigned to me, one named Sukina, the other Marichpa. They tend to me like court-appointed maids, at my side the moment I need them. Bright-eyed and filled with laughter, they have greatly elevated my spirits, which had been lagging these past several weeks. Christmas away from home was most trying, and though John endeavored to explain to me that I had a new home now, it only made matters worse. That home is, of course, the grand house, and what pieces of information we've obtained while away are encouraging indeed. The walls are up, the roof going on. It is said to have 30 windows on the front of the house alone. The glass is being ordered for them now. I have continued to collect, starting in the Pacific Islands with lovely wood carvings, some coral, and one enormous fish that John had taxidermied. Its species escapes me, though. Indirectly, he's told me a dozen times, as he loves telling this fishing story at nearly every dinner table we enjoy. I believe John caught some 200 fish during the course of our stay, and with only this one to remember it by, he stretches the story a little longer, the fish too, each time he tells it. But John started me thinking about the house, and now I find I am hard-pressed to do otherwise. Planning for its decoration and its completion consumes me. I bought 100 yards of silk for wall covering while in Siam, beige and exquisitely woven. Another 100 yards of a similar linen, also for wall covering. We skipped India because of the anti-colonial uprisings there. John keeps encouraging me to buy, 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 emphasizing the enormity of our future home. To my great relief, the home itself has drawn us close together again. We talk of it constantly, consulting the plans, he inviting my opinion. I can actually see it growing as we discuss it, as strange as that may sound. These visions of mine seem a preternatural connection to the house itself, effortlessly reaching across the thousands of miles of ocean. A radio of the mind. Radio has not yet reached Seattle, but it was all the talk before we left. I have kept the existence of these visions to myself. John has no mind for any of it, while all the time actually seeing the house grow behind the work of the hundreds of men now on site. A most remarkable thing happened 2 days ago, worth sharing here. In studying the plans with John, he was pointing out the breakfast room, a well-intentioned space left of the banquet hall and below the kitchen on our plans, and one obviously thought up by a man. I'm annoyed with its placement, as its only windows face west into the garden, and any woman knows that it is the morning's east light that so pleases the morning soul. John argues that I may take my breakfast wherever it pleases me, including the parlor, which does, in fact, face east and south, but with an uninspired view of the driveway. He reminds me that the home will be staffed with over 30, and that if I wish to have breakfast in bed every day of my life, so be it. But he misses the point, of course, of the aesthetics of the placement of the breakfast room, and my belief that it shall go virtually unused because of it. No matter. What was astonishing was this. In the course of our heated discussion, John pointed to a second of the room's windows in the plans. I told him no, that the window had been lost, as the architect had only recently discovered a need to relocate the pantry from north to south to provide better access to cold storage and the china storage in the basement below, access to which was to the north of the kitchen. He'd heard nothing of this, he reminded me, even taking the time to sort through his many telegraphs. But you see, I knew, quite clearly, that this change had been made. I had seen the wall being erected already, the bricks laid in place, the trowels tossing the mortar. I knew, and no one had ever told me. When John received a telegraph late that evening, he came to our rooms somewhat ashen. He passed me the telegraph and said, "Explain this, Ellen." "A premonition is all, my love."
"A premonition?"
"Exactly so."
"Concerning the house," he said.
"This particular time, yes."
"You've had others, then?"
"The world is opening up to me, dear husband, just as you said it would. This voyage of ours has already proved most illuminating. One might even say enlightening."
"And what else do you see, if I may ask?"
"You dare not ask, I would suggest."
"Me? Is it ever me?"
He looked nervous, visibly upset. "And if it was?"
"I don't believe in such rubbish."
"Then you've nothing to worry about, dear soul."
"Do not call me that."
"I see you with women," I answered. "Young women, barely budding. I see you performing unspeakable acts with these dark women with whom we've surrounded ourselves since we left home." I was crying now, but trying so hard not to. I'm sure I must have looked the fool. He blanched.
"Ridiculous!"
A hoarse, dry whisper that I fear even he did not believe. Void of the usual flare of temper, he left our rooms in quietude. To my surprise, he returned later, sober and unusually considerate and polite. That night, he was husband to me, as gentle as our wedding night. He luxuriated me in my own pleasures, as he has never done before. And later, I heard him crying in his sleep. "It's the air, dear diary, the all-important air. I am now the vehicle through which to deliver him his lineage, and any other will be bastard. I fear we have left a string behind us on this trip already. He needs me in this endeavor, my willingness to take to bed with him, or this dream of passing along his fortune will never take light. It is this need that compels him to treat me with respect and dignity, no matter what the truth of our union be. I do believe I have struck the fear of God in him.
But truth be known, it is the devil. For who else invoked in me such a lie as I told him that night, having never had such visions of him with others? Suspicions, to be sure, but brought forward as images, I do believe that he briefly saw them as well, reliving his unfaithfulness, and that perhaps these memories, so vivid and so clear, afforded him the opportunity to believe that I too had witnessed his depraved acts. Am I to believe he simply invents these things he puts me through when in bed with him? He learned them, of course, and we both know it. And we also know that I am not that teacher. And so the little games we play continue, acting out husband and wife, reviewing our grand house plans as if none's the worry. Me, beginning to communicate with Sukina and enjoying her company so very much. He, taking off on his safaris for days at a time and returning with guilt on his face and a fallen impala under his arm. Me with my visions, he with his dreams. And my womanhood, the secret that holds the balance for both of us. When my monthly issue does come, he shrinks into the bottle and depression for days, only to return to try again, sometimes tenderly, sometimes desperately. I am the key to his future happiness, and he, in turn, is the key to mine. I am beginning to learn the ways of marriage. May 15th, 1908. Kenya, Africa. I have not made entries in this personal chronicle for nearly a month. 3 weeks and 5 days, to be exact. I do so now, only weekly, unable to hold this pen for long, I'm afraid. I have been unconscious for some of this time, and delirious for the rest, stricken with what our recently departed fellow travelers believed was malaria. I have lost no fewer than 15 pounds. My rib cage protrudes front and back like some of the native women in our employ. I have suffered from fever for days at a time, a complete loss of appetite, sweats, and tremors. Only through the tender care of Sukina and her bitter teas and remedies she has fed me, and my own endless prayers for recovery, have I survived. For these 4 weeks, I have never left the confines of my tent, quarantined from all but the natives. Even John has avoided contact, standing outside at the far end of my tent and talking to me through a small triangle of light caused by a turned-up tent flap. It is this isolation that has worn on me, driven me at times to the very edge of my sanity. Only my rough conversations with Sukina, an awkward combination of words and gestures, have maintained my link to this world. In my delirium, I have traveled to unthinkable places, at times believing it so real, only to have Sukina pull me back. I do believe that no less than 3 times I was within a breath or two of death, hovering in a nether world where at once I felt both refreshed and fearful. This delicate contact with what I perceive of as the other side has left me far less apprehensive of my own demise, and yet with mixed opinion as to whether I was in heaven, or hell, or purgatory. What I know, and know for certain, is that God saved my life, but that the devil may have bargained for my soul. The exact conversations escape me now, though they were extremely clear at the time. But I know for certain I made promises that, perhaps, I should not have made. Sukina, who has served me as both nursemaid and witch doctor,
as sister and friend, has known the truth all along, that my fevers and infirmity resulted neither from the water nor from the jungle insects that do infest this godless place. Instead, my illness was contracted by contact with my husband, for I am plagued by an unmentionable disease carried by men and suffered by women. The remedy for my affliction is most unpleasant, though as I understand it, it is far less worse than it is, or will be, for John, who has no doubt undergone, and will continue to undergo, a series of injections to an area of the male body that is also unmentionable. This, in turn, explains John's sweats of nearly 6 weeks ago, a lingering illness that put him of foul mood, unable to walk, and accounted for his sending for certain medications, of which I was unaware until Sukina recently informed me. His recovery, however, appears to have gone much more quickly than my own, for he has returned to hunt and safari these last 3 weeks while I lay here in my tent. I am told, again by Sukina, that the reverse is usually true, that women tend to suffer far less than men from this horrible affliction. What curse on me reversed these odds? Husband and wife have not spoken of this, nor will we ever. Of this I am certain. Much have I cried and agonized over my husband's unfaithfulness, his failure to live up to the mutual consent of our marriage vows, and the lack of respect he has shown me. Much have I now suffered for his pleasures, and I ache for a way to return such shame and pain to him. It is the heir, of course, to deny him the right to continue his line. But I cannot throw myself into this cause with much heart, for I, too, would welcome the distraction of children. And yet the thought of joining him physically I find so repugnant as to literally make me sick to my stomach. I vomit if any such image enters my mind. I expel it and swear it will never come to fruition. I have now lived the error of forgiveness, for certainly I've known all along what he was up to. I will never fool myself again. He will be made to beg me. He will be made to cry, to pay, both financially and emotionally, for the trials he has put me through, if he wishes to have his heir. This inferno that has lived in my loins and in my head these many weeks has taken root in my condemnation of my husband and my determination for revenge. If it's money that he loves, then I shall bleed him. This grand house of his will never be complete. Construction will never stop. No expense will be spared. He will watch as the frivolity of my mood directs the depletion of his funds in whatever unnecessary and trivial manner I can and do imagine. And he will be loath to stop it, to even try, for my legs shall close upon his lineage forever like a springed trap. The call for revenge drives me to take the soup Sukina offers, to allow my sweat-soaked bedsheets and nightgown to be removed and replaced, rather than succumb to the fevers, to tolerate the treatment Sukina puts me through, at once both painful and humiliating. I will prevail to leave this tent, to face my husband across the dinner tables erected beneath what appears to be a banyan tree. I will look him in the eye and show him my resolve to right his wrong. And he will know. He will wither under the power I have gained, both through my prayers, to both sides, and from my dear friend Sukina. She has the power to heal, the power to connect to the other side. Her dolls of black hardwood, her musical chants and infusions. In what my husband may only slowly come to see, my illness has led to strength of mind, my suffering to strength of heart. He will come to regret his infidelity, ultimately and forever. And I shall triumph, Sukina at my side. She is coming home with us. This is the first of many concessions my husband shall learn to make. June 15th, 1908, Cairo, Egypt. I cannot imagine any place hotter in all the world than Cairo in June. We have sailed down the Nile for days. How strange a world this is, that north is downstream. John is foul of mood, and no wonder. He has not won my affections since late April, when he bestowed upon me that horrible curse. And now, in such close company as this small flat-bottomed boat, he cannot find any budding young women to pluck, except those of the European families that people this vessel, girls who can speak, read, and write, girls who would report him in an instant if he lifted their skirts. He broods and drinks, and brags with the other passengers, wisely leaving Sukina and me to ourselves, except at dinner, at a tedious captain's table, where liquor is the official language, and all but I speak fluently. I hear him tell his hunting stories, and marvel at his ability to win friends, and I watch the women swoon, and I wonder if that is how I once looked in his company as well. I want to hate him, but that vexation is slowly wearing off. Calculated or not, he has taken some time to charm me, has helped me pick out several splendid rugs from Persia, bought in Luxor, and a great deal of woven wicker, baskets and hampers mostly, some 75 in all. The prize so far is the hand-carved alabaster. We are to have dinner, bread, and salad plates, soup bowls of two sizes, all for a table of 40. It is to be shipped to Seattle within the year, each piece carefully packed. John said that if half the cargo arrived undamaged, we should consider it a victory, at which point I increased the alabaster order to a serving for 80, and watched John wince at the increase in price, although these dirt-poor Egyptian farmers are practically giving away such wares. I could have increased it to 800 and not taken a week of my husband's income. Indeed, if I am to have any revenge on my husband, I see clearly now that it absolutely must come in the construction of the grand house. That is the only weapon I possess. I have come to detest the Europeans for their treatment of my dear Sukina. Of those who acknowledge her presence, precious few, I'm sorry to say, few treat her with any respect above a slave. A French couple was nice to her. The woman offered her some clothes that would fit. Mine are far too small for her, and she accepted. A Canadian woman was quite thoughtful and respectful, and always greeted Sukina by name. The rest were brutes. I was glad to be free of the Sun Ra, even if it meant the streets of Cairo. Few cities in the world are as densely populated as this one. Brown bodies by the millions, all covered in long cotton robes of soft browns and a few subtle greens. They look like nightgowns, as if everyone has just woken up. The men wrap their heads in white cotton. The women cover their faces, all but the black eyes that stare straight ahead, unseeing, and yet all-seeing. Water buffalo drag carts through the streets, but foul the sun-baked brick and make a stink that rises with the sun. People wash themselves in the river. This river, that is the heart of the land. They wash their babies, their food utensils, their camels. The river is putrid and foul, and they practically live in it. But to the story at hand. Sukina and I were bicycled by rickshaw into the city's main market, deep in the center of humanity. We were not, by any means, the only visitors to this city, but it felt that way. We collected some trinkets, a good deal of colorful fabrics, and a few more pieces of alabaster, these ornately carved. All our goods were stacked high on the three-wheeled bicycle, our driver never hesitating a moment to add to his load. After about an hour of this, we took tea in a small tea-house where young boys circulated the air by manning large fans. The tea helped me to perspire, which in turn cooled me off. I made the mistake of showing my coin purse to pay for the tea, a practice John has warned me against time and time again, and one I just cannot seem to master. At any rate, I committed this mistake. John is right, of course, and must have shown to all those looking a good deal of bills within that small purse, for John had just exchanged some dollars upon our arrival and had provided me appropriate spending money. I realize now this must have been staged, but at the time the commotion that arose at the front of the building drove Sukina and me to the rear, in hopes of escaping the melee. As we slipped out the back, not one, but two very evil-minded men approached, their message clear from the knives they carried, the purse or our lives. I nearly fainted at this threat of violence, and it did not escape me that, as men confronting a white-skinned woman, they might want more than just my purse. I willingly offered the purse, but Sukina lovingly took hold of my arm, shook her head, no, and made me to hold on to it. One of the two stepped forward, I believe to challenge us, certainly to challenge Sukina. But that brave woman stood tall, her skin so dark it shined blue. "Nubian," they called out in their foreign tongue. And then I witnessed with my own eyes a side of Sukina I had never before seen. She stared at this man, a glaring stare unlike anything, impossible to describe. She stepped toward him, her body fluid and flawless, moving more like a wave than a step, a snake than a legged creature. And all the while, a deep, low, guttural sound pulsated from her throat and chest. The sound seemed to surround us. The man, increasingly uncomfortable with her approach, took a step back, the first sign she had dominion over him. At this point, the guttural sound evolved into language, a tongue I had never heard, not in all our travels in the Dark Continent. But this man and his associate apparently understood the primitive message she imparted. As she waved her hands, the man stopped, absolutely still as marble. That knife carried as an ornament, not a weapon. Both men began to tremble, and I swear I felt the earth beneath my feet rumbling like a self-contained earthquake. Then they folded in on themselves and writhed in pain on the ground as if stricken by some disease to the stomach or bowels. What began as their moaning developed into cries of terror. Sukina took my hand, stepped around the one in front of us, and led me down the alley to our waiting driver. As I looked back, the men were still groaning miserably. Sukina has not spoken of the incident, and I, for one, am glad of that fact, for I'd know not what to say. But I am less concerned about travel deep into these foreign streets now. I feel protected, defended against the dark side by my African friend. I am more intrigued by her unspeakable powers. Where such powers come from, and whether or not a person can learn them, can adopt them for her own, I have yet to discover. But with Sukina to teach me, I suddenly feel that anything is possible. Anything my heart desires. July 4th, 1908. Crete, Greece. Our nation's birthday was met by much drinking on John's part. He began his celebrations before noon, partaking in the clear liquor these fishermen drink by the shot, said to be a variation on grain alcohol. The Greeks, of course, have little, if any, idea of our Independence Day, and must find John's display of patriotism somewhat confounding. Sukina and I toured a ruin, an old port city, now inland by a quarter mile, rocked above sea level in a seismic shift 2,000 years earlier. We visited a row of stone tubs used for washing laundry, so well preserved that all they lacked was a stopper and some soap to be put back into service. This is the land of raw olive oil, squid, and goats that climb trees. I saw this with my own eyes. A quiet, peace-loving peasant people with a rich appetite for cafe discussion, drinking, and coffee so strong and bitter that it turns my stomach. It was here, this morning, in a spectacular suite of rooms overlooking the rich, blue depths of the Mediterranean, that my will surrendered to John for the first time since this past April. The morning broke incredibly hot, and I slipped out of bed to stand by the ocean breeze at the window, when my husband took hold of me from behind, his massive hands beneath my gown, before my voice could rise to protest. I grabbed for either side of the open French doors and braced myself, casting myself forward and clearly inviting his ardor, the hem of my nightgown riding on my hips, his brazen intentions driving me to my toes, my knees quivering, my heart racing. My God, I must admit here to the thrill of it all. Our passions mutually heightened by my months of refusal, John's aggressiveness, so masculine and forceful, yet careful and kind to me. I could not maintain my footing, and therefore slowly sank to my knees, my husband keeping us joined and fervently pursuing his climax, to where, in a dizzying moment of unbridled sensation, I tried to call out to him, only to hear my voice moan through indistinguishable syllables that he clearly took as a signal. We collapsed in a gasp of satisfaction, he on my back, me with my face pressed to the tile floor. This is hardly a situation becoming of a lady, I said weakly, winning a spontaneous eruption of laughter from the both of us. "Our morning ride," he said, and we laughed again. When we were apart, he rolled me over and we lay together again, half in, half out of our bedroom, half in, half out of consciousness, basking in the morning sunshine, basking in our union. I wrapped my legs tightly around his waist and heard myself say, "It's all behind us, yes?" "I have hope it is." "Never again." "Never," he said, gently touching my cheek. "I was a fool, Ellen." And then the words I had prayed to hear. "Forgive me." "We will not speak of it. Not now. Not ever." From where this capitulation arose, I know not. Perhaps I wanted a marriage back, a life. Perhaps my confidence in Sukina's enormous powers made John Rimbauer less of an obstacle and more of a game to me. I felt more the cat than the mouse. I had what he wanted, ability to deliver his heir. He had what I had quickly grown accustomed to, position, power and tremendous wealth. As we lay there, this 40-year-old man grew ardent yet again, and again I capitulated. And for the first time since our marriage, I directed him as to the choreography of my pleasure. With each instruction I gave, I witnessed arousal in my husband, excitement. He would answer each touch I gave to him with a hearty, throaty, yes, and do exactly as I wished. I tell you, dear diary, I never knew. But under my careful instruction, both of the hips and the hands, he did pleasure me, carrying me to new sensations that both alarmed me, for my surrender to them, and overcame me with pure and perfect delight, my every muscle on fire at once. My legs still gripped around him. I eased my damp head of hair back to resting, my chest a florid pink, my husband panting like a long-distance runner. "Good boy, Johnny," I said, using a nickname I had never dared use before, adopting an attitude, as much a test as a conviction. He placed his head on my chest, and briefly was that little boy I had complimented. I cannot explain in these pages, but in that moment the tide of our relating husband to wife did shift, wife to husband. I gained the strength and courage to express my physical desires, and in doing so, somehow, also gained the upper hand over my formerly defiant husband. I didn't want to think about the past. I wanted to command the future. As we dressed and took coffee on the balcony, I felt another stirring in my loins, and nearly requested my husband's favors yet again. But this stirring was something altogether different from a woman's urges. At first I blamed this awful coffee, and then later the excitement pent up from my morning discoveries and the accomplishment of one part of my dream. But then I blamed the act itself, or the acts, if one is counting, for though I'd never experienced the condition firsthand, could only speculate on the sensations surging through my soul, not my body, but my soul, I sensed the presence of another life, a life within me. I was pregnant. I knew this absolutely and with all conviction. The first fledgling moments of a human being were growing inside me. When Sukina saw me, it was all but confirmed. She met me in our rooms, looked deeply into my eyes, and smiled widely. "So," she said in her pidgin English, "it has begun."
"Indeed it has."
This ends Disc 2.